Good afternoon, and welcome to Seattle and to the Nakamura Courthouse. This is the time set for oral argument in the case of Maricruz Marisol Rojas Espinosa versus Todd Blanch. The counsel could please come forward.
May it please the court. My name's Elizabeth, or I'm sorry, could I start already?
Yes, you can. If you can pull those microphones down, so speak right into them so we can hear you.
Okay. Thank you. Is this okay?
Better.
Okay. Thank you. May it please the court, Elizabeth Rodriguez appearing for petitioner Ms. Rojas Espinosa, her partner, and her two minor children. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would like to make 4 points today. The first point is that the board failed to meaningfully analyze the family-based nexus, and instead we would argue collapsed the case into private criminality. The second point is that the board's PSG analysis was too rigid and did not address the preserved family kinship theory. Third, the agency's treatment of government inability or unwillingness in CAT was legally incomplete because they discounted the country conditions and evidence and the fact that the threat followed petitioners even after she relocated. So essentially that argument would be based on that they did not aggregate the different events. And fourth, the state issue. Which should be viewed through the current fully developed record, the serious merits questions that are being raised, and the particularized threat of death, sexual violence, and family targeting.
So on the stay, can I ask, first of all, is your client still in the United States?
As far as I know, yes.
Okay, so we denied a stay in March, but as far as you know, he has not yet been removed?
As far as I know, no.
Okay. And so you're asking us, you're asking us to grant the petition for review. If we do that,
well, to
there's
reinstate
nothing to stay
it.
Then, right?
I'm sorry?
If we agree with you that the petition for review should be granted, then we would set aside the removal order and there wouldn't be anything to stay at that point, would there?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And if we deny the petition for review, I take it there would be no basis for a stay, right?
That's correct. Yes.
And I guess my last question on the stay is that there was some, as you're aware, the three-judge panel issued an order or issued an opinion that addressed the question of, you know, how stays ought to be processed. Do you care about any of that?
I do care, and I do.
Well, why?
Why do I care?
You care about whether you get a stay now, but why does your client care about the timing of our processing of stays in general?
Well, I don't know that my client necessarily would know about the processing of stays, but I would believe that it's important to her because, especially an asylum case, like this one is, there is a risk to her and her family of harm, as discussed in the briefs.
Right, but I guess the question, you know, the panel opined on whether, you know, when there's an opposed stay motion, it should go to the first available, you know, motions panel, or whether it can be, you know, deferred to be considered with the merits. I mean, those sort of questions, I take it your client doesn't have any position on.
My client specifically, I don't know that she does have a position. I would at least agree with the court that if there is an objection, there should be some sort of follow-up by the court.
But your client has no, I mean, like, unless your client is going to get removed and come back, this is not something those issues are not going to affect your client in any way, are they?
The procedural aspect that the court takes? No.
Okay.
Okay.
Judge Wardlaw?
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on that because my understanding is not that neither you nor the government actually briefed or argued the question of Nikin and GO64C, correct?
I think it cut up a little bit. If you could,
she was asking. Okay. In fact, below, I mean, before the panel and your briefing before the panel and your argument before the panel, neither you nor the government raised the whole Rule 6.4C issue, correct?
I believe that's correct, yes. I think at least for petitioner's side, the only briefing that was made on the stay was the initial filing, and then there was nothing after that. Other than the respondent's opposition to it.
Counsel, you had filed a motion for a stay in this case, right?
Yes. Okay. Usually that's filed at the same time, or at least this office files it at the same time as the petition for review.
Okay. And that stay was temporarily administratively granted. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And for about at least 10 months?
Yes, minimum 10 months.
Okay. And in your stay, you cited a provision of the Immigration Naturalization Act that purportedly provided for an automatic stay?
Yes, I do. I did see that, yes.
Okay. You realize that that provision was repealed decades before you filed your motion for a stay?
Yes. Well, to clarify, I didn't file that myself, but I did review that filing, and yes, I would agree with the court that that has been repealed.
Okay. And that stay motion, have you used that stay motion in other templates in filing?
I believe so. I think the office does use that pretty regularly. So, yes.
Is it still including that now repealed statutory citation?
I would hope not, but I think it is something that I will have to take back to the lead attorney. Yes.
All right, counsel, what is the PSG here that you are arguing for?
So the PSG is essentially would want it to be based on the kinship. I believe, and part of our argument is that the agency looked at it too strictly because it included the word targeted and then automatically dismissed the rest of the analysis. But really in this case, what we're arguing is that the basis of the claim was on the family kinship itself, because the person here, the petitioner, was targeted specifically because of that relationship, and that is proven by the actions of the actual perpetrators, because they asked specifically for her brother and harmed her because of that relationship.
But when you say agency in this particular case, there's a bit of a discrepancy between what the IJ ruled and what the BIA ruled. But this is a question of law, so the BIA can jump right in there,
right,
and did. And so I just want to make sure that your argument is framed around the BIA's ruling on the PSG. Is that right?
Yes, the BIA's ruling, but if I remember correctly, the BIA's ruling also affirmed what the immigration judge was stating.
So if we decide that the BIA may have affirmed something the IJ didn't do, then I think this wouldn't be a barrier. The BIA would be free, because it's a question of law under our precedent. The PSG is a question of law. The BIA would be free to do that, yes, and to articulate its own reasoning.
It would be free to do that, but our argument is that it really did not do that. It really, for example, well, maybe I'm going to something else, but when we look at the nexus arguments and looking into the reason.
Just on PSG.
We're
just on PSG.
Yes.
And I don't think the IJ said anything about circularity, did the IJ? That's just the BIA, isn't it?
I believe it was just the BIA, okay. Yes.
And that seems to be contrary to Diaz-Reynoso.
Yes.
Okay. And the other thing that the IJ said that you think the BIA may or may not have incorporated is particularity. Is that it?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Oh, I understood you to be saying that the IJ seems to have considered a family social group. Like one of the PSGs the IJ considered was, is family itself enough? And then the BIA didn't talk about that.
It was very conclusory. I think it just went by the what the PSG that was presenting, because it said targeted, and automatically because it said targeted, it said that it was circular.
Right. But like, if there was a family group, I wondered if the IJ had also considered what might have counted as a number four in the BIA's three, which is just family by itself. And the BIA maybe incorporated the IJ on that, but didn't separately address that fourth articulation.
Right. Yes. Correct. Okay. Should I continue?
Counsel, I just wanted to clarify. So what can you state? Well, how should I, let me put it this way. I think before the IJ, maybe your partner at the law firm, Murray Hiltz.
Yes.
He was asked by the IJ, tell me exactly what you want to put for your PSG.
Yes.
And then he says, kinships who are targeted by gangs. And he has other two other PSGs. Kinships who are targeted by gangs. Is that the PSG you're arguing before us here?
Well, I'm not arguing for a whole new PSG or anything of that nature, but I am asking the court to not look at that PSG as it was articulated so strictly, because within that,
that's what you articulated for your client. So
yes, that's okay. Correct. But within that is the kinship, and as I stated earlier, we would argue that that kinship aspect of it should have been analyzed separately, because I believe even with the BIA, they did state that family relationship was cognizable, but then again, they just dismissed it because of that. Just because of that targeting language.
But IJ thought that acknowledged, I think, it's a little fuzzy. The whole record's a bit fuzzy, but I think the IJ acknowledged that there's family that can be a cognizable PSG, and then questioned whether she established that membership in that group by saying that she hadn't established that her brother was her brother.
Yes, I did see that as well. However, I would also say that there wasn't really any notice that that would have to be corroborated when she was found credible.
Forgive me for interrupting, but the BIA didn't affirm that or didn't incorporate that part of the reasoning, right? So that falls out of the analysis, I think. Membership falls out, and that would be a question of fact in any way.
Yes.
So back to what the BIA did rule, right? Because PSG is a legal conclusion, and
right.
The BIA mentions circularity, which I think we've touched on that, and then particularity.
Yes.
We have case law saying that a family social group is the quintessential PSG.
Yes. Correct.
Counsel, you're not changing your PSG description, right?
No, I'm not.
It's the same before the IJ and before the BIA?
Yes, that's correct. It's the same. But again, we're just asking that it not be looked at so strictly, especially when that stated PSG does have kinship within it, and
they don't look at it so strictly. Forgive me for interrupting, but I have Judge Tong's question as well. What exactly do you mean? You stated it this way: kinships who are targeted by gangs,
correct?
And you want us to interpret it how or what?
Well, it would be the substance is the kinship, so it would be the kinship to the brother. So I think that is included even within that PSG. So that's why we're saying we're not changing it.
Is the brother included in the PSG? Is he a member of that PSG?
I don't know that he would be, because part of our argument also is that he couldn't be, because the reason she was targeted was specifically because of the relationship to him. But the reason he was targeted was not clear, at least not before the record. And in fact, she did say that she wasn't sure why he specifically was targeted.
But if we assume that he was targeted for some motivation that was entirely criminal, let's say. So if he had been a petitioner, which he is not, mm-hmm. let's say it's completely not cognizable, right?
Yes.
Then for the nexus question, the question is, why was she targeted? And what's your analysis there for her?
So for her, it would be that she was specifically targeted because of her relationship to the brother. From the beginning of her testimony, she stated that they approached her because of the brother, not because of anything that she did or may not have done. It was always because of that relationship. And had that relationship not existed, then there would not be any harm.
So is the attacker's motive for seeking vengeance for Rojas Espinosa's brother relevant to the nexus inquiry?
I think it's a factor, but I think here what's important is the relationship and why they are persecuting her specifically.
In what way is it even a factor in this?
Well, it's a factor because it's part of the story, but I would say, again, that it's not what's important. The petitioner here is the petitioner, and the brother is not, and I don't know actually what he's doing for his case or whether he's doing anything, but here the question is what happened to her and why that happened to her, and in this case, it is the relationship to the brother.
So under your theory, suppose there's drug dealer A, drug dealer B. Drug dealer A steals drugs from drug dealer B, who then gets mad and says, return my drugs or I'm going to kill your wife and your best friend. So under that theory, would the wife of drug dealer A be eligible for asylum or meets the nexus requirement?
She would be based on the relationship, presumably, of the husband, but I wouldn't say that the husband necessarily would be part of the same PSG because the reasoning why they're going after him would be different.
Isn't that an oddity in your theory, that the person who's directly harmed can't seek asylum on a protected ground, but a person who happens to be related to that person who's being targeted can seek asylum?
Perhaps, but I think there has been a lot of case law that states that, you know, if it's not related to a particular social group or political opinion, then unfortunately that person may not be protected. So in this case, we're saying that there is kinship and she does fall under that protection.
It's not a derivative of analysis. We've never said that.
No.
Right. So there may be, if we could just play out a few of these hypotheticals, maybe there's a, to use Judge Lee's point, there's a person who is in a rival drug gang or a rival union or a rival whatever you want, and a criminal act is taken against him or her. Let's make it a husband to just be stereotypical. So you have this husband, and he's in a rival drug gang, and he is targeted by drug gang B, and his girlfriend or his, I guess his wife is with him. If the car he's riding in is sprayed with bullets, I think you would agree she doesn't have a claim. She's caught in the crossfire. She's there. That's just a criminal act. The difference is if the gang, there's this interaction, an attempt by one drug cartel to take out the leader of the other drug cartel. But next week, the aggressive drug cartel comes after a wife or a girlfriend because of that relationship, because they want to retaliate, because they want to put pressure on, because they want to exact additional, maybe a ransom. That person has a nexus then.
Yes. But, well, we would probably have to look at the case more, but yes.
It's very fact specific, right. I think, is what I'm trying to say. It seems to be very fact specific. You just happen to have a case where she's separated from her brother both temporally, and they come on this record, they come after her not because she's a random victim of crime, but because she's his sister.
Yes, and that's essential argument that it was not a random act against this person. It was specifically because of that relationship. And we would say that the BIA did not look at that, instead just said this is private criminality.
Go ahead, Judge Miller.
And so what do we do with the paragraph at the bottom of page 4 of the record, page 2 of the board's order, that, you know, after discussing the groups, including kinships who are targeted by gangs, the board says that the evidentiary record does not demonstrate that respondents were or will be targeted on account of their membership in those groups. And the next sentence, respondents have only offered speculation as to the motives of their purported persecutors. So you need to show that that was not supported by substantial evidence, right? Which in turn requires you to show that any reasonable fact finder would be compelled to reach a contrary conclusion on nexus. And so what is the evidence that you would point us to that supports that view?
So in support of that view, we would say the actions themselves against the petitioner. So in this case, after her brother, even after the brother leaves the country, they came after her, they choke her, they attempt to rape her. And then later she relocates, and then again they find her. And I believe it was she lived in Cañete, and I believe then she moved to Lima.
But isn't your answer because they said we're looking for your brother? yes. in each of those times. That's the answer, right? The nexus comes from the fact that they said they were looking for the brother.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's my point in saying that there was nexus to the group that was discussed, the kinship. But then in also looking at the sequence of events that they even found her even after she relocated, that also supports the claim.
But the board addressed that point in like a couple sentences down by saying that I think the inference the board drew from that was they're looking for the brother, and when the brother's not there, they target her. But it, I guess the board's view is it doesn't follow that they're targeting her because of the brother, as opposed to just, you know, randomly after not finding the brother. So why is that an impermissible inference for the board to draw?
Well, because they specifically are from the beginning, they said, we are looking for your brother. And then when she says, well, I'm sorry, I forgot what she said, but the point is that she didn't know where he was or that he left. They then continued to harm her and look for her.
But if you had the same fact pattern and you didn't have the sentence or the statement that Judge Friedland's called your attention to, you might not have a showing of nexus. These are very fact-specific cases, are they not?
Yes, I agree. But in this case, it is part of the record, and she was found credible, and she testified that they specifically were looking for her because of that relationship.
And so the attenuated, after she moved, you take the inference you take from that is that they were really targeting her, because this is a follow-on attack after the original one in which the statement was made.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Correct. Thank you.
Can I ask you something about this, going back to the stay? So if we were to conclude that the agency made a mistake here on nexus and agree with you and remand to the agency to look at this case again on a correct analysis of nexus, were we wrong to vacate the stay? Like, is the stay, basically what I'm trying to ask is the stay of removal about whether you would get further proceedings, succeed in getting further proceedings, or is it really about ultimately whether after whatever proceedings are going to happen, your client is eventually going to get permanent relief?
So I'm sorry, I couldn't hear Judge Friedland, your last.
So my question is, what does the stay of removal mean when we look at likelihood of success on the merits? Is it looking at whether you will succeed in getting a remand to the agency by having this petition granted, in which case, if we agree with you that we should remand to the agency and grant this petition, we probably were wrong to vacate the stay? Or is likelihood of success asking about whether eventually, after whatever proceedings happen between us and the agency, she will eventually get asylum? If that's the question, then maybe we don't even know if we were right to vacate the stay or not, because she may or may not eventually get asylum. Which one of those is the likelihood of success analysis?
I'm not sure I understand it completely. But
when we have to think about whether there's a likelihood of success for whether we should grant a stay of removal, do we just have to think about whether this petition might be granted and remanded to the agency?
So I think, yes, in looking at the merits of the case and in looking at the different issues, whether there is merits to the arguments made, then yes, the stay should have been granted.
Like, it's possible that your client will succeed on making this nexus argument, but will have a problem with relocation or some other factor. Is that part of the analysis on likelihood of success for the stay of removal, or is it just if she's going to be able to get a remand to the agency because what the agency said is wrong?
Well, I mean, ultimately, the goal is that she would be granted asylum, obviously. But if that doesn't happen, and let's say there are other issues, I think the other factor is obviously that there's an interest in not removing someone who has a history or a fear of return because of events that were violent, and that there's an interest, a public interest, in not allowing that to happen in this case.
Can we go back to the PSG and nexus? I mean, here there's no classic PSG, like someone being persecuted because of religion, ethnicity, etc. But just using family as a nexus, I mean, it seems like we're creating, it's almost like alchemy here. We're creating something that doesn't exist because, you know, bad people will threaten family members all the time for their bad purposes. I mean, that's just reality. It happens. Gang members will threaten someone, and then I'm going to, you know, threaten your spouse, children, etc. So it seems we're really opening the doors if we consider family in such a broad way as a basis for a nexus for a PSG here.
Well, I would say that, again, it's just very fact specific. And we also have to look at the remainder of the issues, which in this case would also be that there's an argument that there's no real protection from the government. So I think it would just have to be very fact-specific and careful into if that is taken, that it doesn't really open the door, because that's not really what we're asking, that we open the door for everyone. I don't know if I answered that appropriately.
Well, threats alone typically are not enough. But and there would have to be risk of harm. It's got to be objectively reasonable and subjectively reasonable. And depending on the claim, she'd have to show that the government isn't able or willing to protect her. And there's quite a number of other elements to get to.
Right.
Right. Beyond right. Nexus.
Yes.
And I think in this case, the agency didn't reach them yet. So.
Yes, that's correct. And again, that's a lot of what we're saying in the argument.
I'm sorry, before you move on, I'd like to ask you a question about the nexus argument. So what you're arguing is that because she says, she didn't say in her declaration, she did not say it in her declaration, but when she testified at the hearing, she said these hooded individuals approached her, asked where her brother was located. She didn't know. And then they attacked her. So we should draw the inference from that, that the reason they attacked her was because of her brother, because she was his sister, and so it was part of the family. But it seems the agency drew the inference that she was a target of opportunity. They approached her, said, "Where's your brother?" "I don't know." Well, meanwhile, now we have a woman in front of us, and we're going to rape her. And the BIA seemed to draw that inference. This is just random criminality, that the nexus is not established if there's nothing more than what than what she said there, which is not much. So why is that not supported by substantial evidence? I mean, why are we compelled to draw a different inference and inference and reach a different result?
Well, because even in looking at that, it was not just one instance where they found her and asked her, "Where's your brother?" And then they said, "Okay, here's a woman and let me go ahead and harm her." There was, again, a sequence of events after that fact, you know, to where she relocated and they still went after her. And as she stated, I believe in her testimony, there was nobody else that she had issues with. So
she said she went to her cousin's home in another city and there was a note with a bullet, but what did the note say? I mean, she didn't provide it, right? So there's no copy of it there. What does she say the note said? Does it say, "We're coming after you because of your brother"?
I don't think in that note it specifically mentioned the brother, but it just stated, "We're going to harm you or kill you."
But so she's now a target,
yes,
presumably. So again, they've attempted to rape her and attack her. She was able to get away because police were in the area. Mm-hmm. And she leaves and they now are after her. But what's the inference that it's because of her brother? I mean, now she's become their target, but it doesn't seem there's a reasonable inference that it has nothing to do with the brother.
Because otherwise, that would have never happened had that initial.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, maybe they wandering down the street and they see her and they decide to attack her.
Well, but then we're just speculating that maybe could happen.
Well, the agency drew an inference that she was a target of opportunity. Mm-hmm. That she was a victim of crime. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that's so unreasonable, there's no substantial evidence, that cannot be an inference that's drawn, we're compelled to reach a different inference. And that's what we'd have to do to say that the agency erred in its nexus analysis.
Yes. So I think the strongest evidence for that is that second contact, which was the bullet, which was very imminent. Ominous.
Strongest contact that had said nothing about her brother or family, well, or anybody else.
Maybe it said nothing about her brother, but that the only reason would be because of the brother, because like she stated in her testimony, she had no other issues with anybody else. And that initial contact, even if it was prior to the second one, it was because of that connection to her brother and not for any other reason.
That's the inference you're drawing, which yes, may be a reasonable inference, but perhaps not the only inference.
Yes, I would agree. Yes.
Do you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Yes, thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Drew Ensign, Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the United States. This court correctly denied petitioner's stay for a request of removal pending review. Petitioner's threadbare motion did not even conceivably satisfy the demanding Niken standard. This court should now use this opportunity to clarify its standards for granting stays pending review and bring them into alignment with Niken, which is binding Supreme Court authority that squarely controls here. In particular, Niken provides that, quote, a reviewing court may not resolve a conflict between considered review and effective relief by reflexively holding a final order in abeyance pending review, end quote.
Counsel, and, in your view, what is the evidence that this was a reflexive order?
It was issued automatically, Your Honor. Under this court's general orders, it was issued automatically. And the, frankly, patent frivolousness of it, it could not have issued as a result of judicial consideration. It issued reflexively because of General Order 6.4. I mean, it's among other faults, it cites 3-decade-old law that is probably not within the bounds of Rule 11 to say that this filing of a stay automatically gets a stay, although ironically, that is in fact what occurred. It relies on a single sentence that it would violate due process not to automatically grant a stay in every single case, but cites no case law for that proposition. It makes no sense either. Even under Matthews v. Eldridge, you'd be looking if there was a pre-deprivation hearing, but they received a pre-deprivation hearing before the IJ and then the BIA. So it's very hard to see how procedural due process could possibly support or mandate an automatic stay in every instance.
So, counsel, is it your opinion that every stay should be denied then?
No, Your Honor. It's that every stay should be decided by Article III judges applying the Niken standard, which is what the Supreme Court has required.
So we did that in March, right? And then you got an order denying the stay.
Yes, right?
So the stay has been denied. So at this point, I mean, you know, sometimes a party has a damages claim, but you know, at this point, what is there? I take it you don't. What is there for us to do about the fact that you suffered a delay before? I mean, you got the order you wanted. You have the order. What's before us now?
Your Honor, certainly this is among the oddest procedural postures that I've encountered. So, among, you know, we asked the court what you would like to address. You specifically said the stays. So here I am addressing the stays. In addition, you're sitting on bonk. You often do so to provide supervisory guidance to the court as a whole. So I don't think, you know, you could always reconsider and grant the stay. So I don't think it's strictly speaking moot. This case is still pending review. You could, in fact, do that. And you could use that as an opportunity to bring this court's practices into alignment with Niken.
Counsel, since you're challenging an administrative order, wouldn't it be more appropriate for the stay procedure to be addressed administratively as opposed to an en banc proceeding?
Your Honor, I think that's an alternative method of challenging it, but I don't think
not that to challenge it, but for because it was an administrative order for the court to look again at that administrative order and determine whether or not there needs to be any adjustment to it.
Your Honor, I think that would be an alternative method of raising it, and certainly we intend to engage with this court on an administrative level, and I've had conversations with the clerk of the court towards that end. But just because something's in an administrative order, that does not bless its violation of binding Supreme Court precedent.
But there's no live controversy on that matter here. As Judge Miller pointed out, the stay's been granted, so we don't have a live controversy on that point today.
I disagree, Your Honor. This case is still pending with the status quo pending.
Case is still pending, but is the issue still pending?
Yes, Your Honor. You could reconsider, and I would urge
you. Has anyone asked for us to reconsider?
Your Honor, we filed a brief asking you to engage with the merits of Niken, and I believe that's squarely before you.
But has anyone asked us to reconsider the denial of the stay?
What's that?
Has anyone asked us to reconsider the denial of the stay?
Your Honor, to the extent that it would cause you to engage with whether or not your practices comply with binding Supreme Court precedent, then I would say that yes, go ahead and reconsider it. If that's what you need as a vehicle to address the legality of your practices, go ahead and reconsider it.
Have you removed the petitioner?
We haven't, Your Honor, kind of for two reasons. One of them is that there is a minor United States citizen that would be removed with them. And so in order to do that removal, they need to get travel documents. That takes some time. And then, and second, the procedural posture is very odd. This is an extraordinary case where, you know, a stay of review was granted. It was then denied. It was then this court stay was then stayed by the court itself, then vacated, then re-granted. Given the sort of whiplash and uncertainty, I'm not surprised that DHS has not, even aside from getting the travel documents, has not done a removal. You know, frankly, I might have been concerned that one or more of you would be upset if, in fact, there was a removal when you had told us that you wanted to address the stay. At an, you know, an en banc is not an ordinary everyday occurrence. So I think those are essentially the multiple reasons why, in this instance, the removal has not yet occurred.
And when we were considering the stay and we were thinking of likelihood of success, what is the question? Is this person ultimately going to get immigration relief, or is this petition going to be successful in getting a remand to the agency?
It's success on the merits. So I think certainly if you look at the Winter Standard, that's ultimate success on the merits. It wouldn't be, you know, if
that's certainly actually, I think our court current precedent is otherwise.
I'm not specifically aware, although I haven't, I'll confess I haven't surveyed this, but, you know, if, for example, you had like a NEPA case, for example, that got dismissed on standing grounds and they appealed to this court and they want an injunction pending, pending appeal, I don't think it would be enough to say we're likely to succeed on standing, therefore give us our injunction on the merits. I think you would actually have to show not just that you were likely to succeed on standing, but that you would have to be succeed on the merits of your NEPA claim. Otherwise, you're getting relief that you couldn't get, otherwise, without ever really having success on the merits. You would have only, in fact, by almost by definition, you didn't have success on the merits. You had success on jurisdiction.
Yeah, but it's difficult in this type of case, isn't it? And I appreciate your grappling with this, that, and the number of cases involved make it hard for everyone, right? For everyone. But it is not uncommon for us to get a case like this where the BIA has really only reached a couple of issues.
Yes,
so
Your Honor.
We can't grant relief. We have to send it back because the petitioner may, and very often does, the claim fails at the next stage, but we're not clairvoyant about what that evidence might be, what they might decide regarding relocation, for example. So what would we do there?
I think you would decide it on the arguments presented. So to the extent that the government doesn't, you know, specifically make arguments about alternative things that are likely to stand as obstacles to ultimate success on the merits on remand, you could treat that as essentially like, you know, you could use the path that has been presented by the parties in their briefing and wouldn't necessarily have to be clairvoyant as to all the possible outcomes that could occur in that, you know, in the process on remand.
Just incidentally, on your comments regarding the stay, I'm wondering if you have any information about the number of stay motions that we receive each year.
So I asked OIL to look at this. The statistics are a little dated because they were last prepared before the government shutdown. So at that time, there were roughly about 500 pending stay motions, I believe. I've asked them to try to update information on that. I don't have that currently. That's something we could try to put together for the court and present it by 28-J letter if that would,
just,
you know, be of interest.
One related question, counsel. Do you know how many of those have been unopposed by the government?
I don't, Your Honor. I believe that number was opposed. We typically oppose, but I can't give you specifics on that. I'd be happy to look at that, but I can't.
Well, it just the logistics, the practical logistics are hard for everybody, right? So the government, there's any number of cases, and I think there's several thousand that have been administratively stayed. The government has given notice that they're reopening those in batches, which is very helpful so we can process them, you know, orderly. and what we're seeing, I think, this is anecdotal on my part, but what we're seeing, I think, very often in those cases, the government's doing its best too, but many times they're requesting extensions because they're stretched really thin and can't brief them either. So we do run very quickly into some pragmatic considerations about these motions for stay.
Your Honor, certainly. And you know, what I might suggest is that we're certainly happy to work with this court on an administrative level to identify, you know, the cases that maybe should be decided first. And we've reached out to DHS about that to identify instances that it makes the most sense to start. Like, if you're clearing the backlog, it makes the most sense to do so. And talking with DHS, what I think make the most sense and what we're looking at is those that are currently in detention with final orders of removal whose country of removal is in the Western Hemisphere, where we essentially have regular removal operations, typically flights on a regular basis. And so, I've heard this court's frustration, particularly I think within the last administration, this court would expend, judicial resources deciding a stay motion, perhaps deny the stay motion, and then the person would not be removed. And, you know, I understand there could be some frustration with, like, no matter whether or not you granted or denied the stay motion, the result would be the same. The alien would not be removed. So I think it certainly makes sense to start with categories where we think removal is quite likely, and you can see that. But, you know, in the long run, this court needs to bring its procedures in line with Niken. You know, it cannot be simply that binding Supreme Court precedent will be followed where we identify particular cases where the need to follow the Supreme Court is particularly acute. It needs to be followed in all cases. And I think, you know, that needs to be the ultimate goal is compliance with Niken. I think the original stay panel opinion identified where that's not occurring. And ultimately the government's position is that that needs to end.
What would that look like? In your perspective.
Which step, Your Honor?
The Niken. You say we have to be in compliance with Niken. What would that look like?
Your Honor, in talking with within OIL and actually some, I believe, kind of with other stakeholders, they've identified the Third Circuit's procedures as something that both the government and stakeholders have found particularly better or a better sort of balancing of it. The way the Third Circuit does it is they have something of a screening mechanism that looks at four questions, whether or not the PFR is timely, whether or not it's in the correct venue, whether or not there's actually a final order of removal, and whether or not the court has authority to review. I think that last one is in part to, you know, review, for example, final order of removal following expedited removal would not be within the Court of Appeals authority. And only after that point does an order issue, and then it's briefed and typically decided within 30 to 45 days.
Who conducts that initial review? Is it a three-judge panel?
I believe it's the clerk's office, but then it ultimately shifts. And we're certainly not advancing the position that administrative stays are per se unlawful. Obviously, we ask for them with some regularity, but they can only last so long as the court needs to decide it. They can't languish.
And so, what does that mean? When we have a circuit that has over half of all of the immigration cases filed in the country.
I don't think your proffer is premised on the notion that the Third Circuit's caseload is comparable.
It is not, Your Honor. Obviously, this court has a disproportionate share of the cases, but ultimately the Supreme Court's decision in Niken does not have an exception for burdened caseload.
Sorry, just asking about this Third Circuit process. Yep. Did you say that? Whether the briefing is complete is part of it or not?
No, Your Honor.
So they would grant an administrative stay as long as there is jurisdiction over the case, basically, and then that stay would be in place at least through the briefing and if there's an argument. So you, at least in our court, the way briefing and argument work, especially with the government getting extensions, it's 6 months then at least. Right,
Your Honor, it's only briefing on the motion for a stay itself. It is not the motion. It's not the merits briefing, so to speak. And so that's why it's fully briefed and decided typically within 30 to 45 days of the completion of the screening and the issuance of that administrative stay.
Right, it just gets tricky because, of course, there's this baked-in likelihood of success question that Judge Friedland was asking you about, and so. I appreciate your offer to that the government's willingness to maybe prioritize the cases that we need to be looking at. I don't want to disregard that. I appreciate that, but I do think this is a lot harder than it looks.
I understand, Your Honor, though I think there's certainly something to Judge Van Dyke's, you know, observation that by giving out stays automatically, it creates some of the very burden that then feeds into the circle of, you know, more filings, that, you know, is certainly it bringing procedures into compliance when they can may help with the burden itself. You know, and I think
I appreciate that. So could you just take one more run at the, maybe the logistics of the backload that we have and looking at the need to write, make a likelihood of success on the merits determination, fuzzy, but a likelihood of success on the merits, given Judge Friedland's point, which is that we very often get requests for extension, understandably, I think the government's scrambling as fast as it can too, but how would that, how would that look going forward?
The nature of an administrative stay is that it's a stay long enough for the court to decide the motion and not further. And Justice Barrett's concurrence in United States versus Texas is pretty instructive on this point. But to the extent the government is requesting an extension on the stay motion, that would necessarily be part of why the court needs more time to decide the stay motion. You know, it's not, in fact, if it's not fully briefed, it's hard to fault the court for not deciding a stay motion in the posture of it's not fully briefed and not ready for decision.
Do you know what the Fifth Circuit's procedure is? Because I assume they have a comparable workload in terms of immigration cases.
I don't specifically know what the Fifth Circuit's procedures are. Its docket is not quite as heavy.
Nothing is comparable to the Ninth Circuit, correct?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. This court accounts for approximately, I believe, 40 to 50% of filings that we handle within the Office of Immigration Litigation. It is by far and away the largest circuit.
Counsel, in light of this discussion, sorry, Judge Miller, what was wrong with what the panel in this case concluded? That if the briefing is completed on the stay motion, then the motion will be given to the next available motions panel. In other words, there is resource considerations baked into the holding itself.
Your Honor, we certainly agree with that. You know, and I think that kind of follows the standard, you know, that an administrative stay should last only so long as the court needs to decide. But if you're referring it to the next available motions panel, I think that, you know, falls within that sort of conception of, you know, that's part of the time that's needed to decide the stay motion.
And just to understand procedurally what we would say here, the opinion that you're envisioning would be, you know, we denied the stay motion. We could reconsider that. I'm not sure petitioner has asked us to, but she could have. We deny reconsideration. And by the way, the clerk's office should start following the procedures in the Third Circuit. I mean, is that sort of what the opinion would say?
Possibly, Your Honor. There is an oddity to this procedural posture where some of this is administrative and some of this is legal. And to the extent that you want to address administrative things, that could either be in, you know, through an en banc opinion. It could be through the administrative processes of this court. We're not going to tell you how to do your own administration. We just ask that it be within the bounds of Niken and the law. As to the opinion, you know, I don't even know that you would need to reconsider. There's also nothing that prevents a court from, you know, issuing an opinion to explain what it's done. It's, you know, it's certainly not unheard of for a court to say, here's our decision and an opinion will follow. You have issued your decision, but you can, you know, it's still a live issue. You could still issue a supplemental opinion that would address these issues if we're just talking about the procedural vehicle.
So, frankly, I'm worried at this point that she does have a likelihood of success. And so we made a mistake in vacating the stay at this point, because I don't understand the nexus now that we've all looked at it more carefully. It seems like she was targeted because of her family relationship with her brother. So could you speak to that merits question?
Certainly. Although if I could say antecedently, the stay could just also be denied because there's just no showing of irreparable harm here beyond removal itself. And that Niken also makes clear that that's not good enough to get a stay.
Well, it's not good enough on its own, but along with likelihood of success, it would be.
Yes, and also, you know, considering the third and fourth factors, basically the, you know, public interest and balance of harms, all of which are necessary. I think the simpler the simpler question here is nexus than PSG. And, you know, I think you need to look no further than their own briefs to understand why the nexus is problematic. I mean, on page 7 of their brief, they said, Mr. Rojas Espinoza's brother, a member of a workers' union, began being mistreated when he openly disagreed with a union raising quotas and attempting to take over more projects from other groups. Then she testified as well that, what you know.
No, the brother was targeted for criminal reasons or union reasons or whatever reasons. But this petitioner, his sister, wasn't she targeted because she was his sister?
That's not the PSG that was presented to the IJ. The IJ, you know, following her attorney, found that the third proposed PSG group was kinships who are targeted by gangs. That is entirely circular.
So, counsel, are you saying kinship is something different than family?
No, I'm saying that her own proposed PSG is not cognizable, and the petitioner needs to be held to the PSG that she exhausted before the IJ and BIA, and in fact is precluded from raising a different PSG than she raised below.
But what do we do with our – we held it in Diaz-Reynoso that, you know, including some non-cognizable group is not – it's not a poison. It's not a poison pill, and that the agency should then take a case-by-case – analysis. So what do we do with that? Because kinship was included here. And, you know, as petitioners argued, maybe the agency should have looked at it less strictly, in the petitioner's words.
Your Honor, that the Diaz decision says that including targeting is not a per se like fatal fault that causes it to be impermissibly circular. But here the proposed PSG is entirely circular. It is simply kinships who are targeted by gangs. It is defined entirely by targeting. And that's it. I mean, are kinships who are targeted by gangs likely to be targeted by gangs? The answer to that is, of course, yes, because the definition is entirely circular. I directed to the Supreme Court decision in Bray as well, which addresses this sort of circularity problem in, I believe, it's either 1983 or the Title VII context.
So what they're suggesting is that the agency, what petitioner's suggesting is that the agency should have just taken that third PSG, kinship who are targeted by gangs, and then parsed it and just considered the word kinship. And considered PSG based on family. And why is that not permissible? Why shouldn't the agency have been required to take out the portion that dealt with targeting because of gangs and just address the kinship or the family PSG?
Well, I think the IJ is only obligated to decide the arguments presented to them. I don't think the IJ is obligated to make a better argument for petitioner than the petitioner's own counsel is making.
I mean, but the IJ did, sir. The IJ acknowledged, he makes a statement, again, it's a little fuzzy, he makes a statement acknowledging that family is, or kinship, is a cognizable PSG. And then what the IJ relied upon is what he thought was the failure for the petitioner to prove their brother was a part of the group. That she was a part of the group, rather. He said she didn't, petitioner, didn't prove that the brother was her brother. That's a different basis entirely.
It is different, Your Honor, but I don't think that matters here because that fuzziness in the IJ was not decision was not the grounds of decision of the BIA, which is before you. The BIA said that third group didn't work because it was impermissibly circular, and I think that's what's squarely before
but the- you. The IJ says this thing about family, and then in petitioner's appeal to the BIA, she says family is a group, and I really am his brother, and there's no reason to think otherwise. And then the BIA just ignores that argument. So at the very least, hasn't the BIA failed to address an issue presented to it that the IJ did consider? I mean, I actually think the BIA incorporated the IJ, but putting that aside, if it didn't, it at very least didn't address that other theory that was presented to it and that was exhausted, at least at the IJ level, by the IJ having reached it.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, and deciding the PSG as was rarely presented to the IJ, I don't think that's committing error. I think that's deciding the issues presented to it.
Well, it didn't say we think the IJ went further than it needed to or something. I mean, it just sort of missed this.
I don't think so. I think it took the definition that was a petitioner's own definition of the proposed PSG and explained why petitioner's own proposed PSG was not legally cognizable. I don't.
Speaking of the IJ or the BIA?
I think the BIA.
If you could go back to Judge Beatty's question, because I didn't mean to deter you from it. Her question, I guess I'm paraphrasing. There was this group. It wasn't squarely presented family as a social group. It's this kinship targeted on account of. And I think the question had to do with why was the IJ required to parse it, right? And I'm trying to get at what your response to that is, because on this transcript, it looks like the IJ did parse. I don't know if the IJ had to, but the IJ did. And I read the record to acknowledge, and as an acknowledgement by the IJ, that the family could be a PSG, a cognizable PSG. Do you read the transcript differently?
Your Honor, I have not parsed that closely. I've looked at certainly the transcript where it has three proposed PSGs, and then the BIA explains why those three proposed BSGs each do not work in turn. I think that's a sufficient basis for decision. I'm there may be stray language that I'm not thinking of recalling to, you know, immediately here, but I think at the end of the day, they proposed three proposed PSGs, and the BIA said why each proposed PSGs, using verbatim language as proposed by petitioner's own counsel, explained why those definitions as proposed by petitioners themselves were not cognizable as a matter of law.
Could I just ask, let's just say for a moment that it had been presented. So I know you don't believe this happened, but if she had proposed a family PSG and the agency had denied it on the ground that because the brother was targeted for being in a union, her PSG of having been targeted as his sister can't succeed because of the union thing. Because even if she was targeted just for his sister, it doesn't matter because it was started with him being targeted for being in a union. Do you think that would be correct reasoning, or would she have a PSG nexus because of her family?
I think that reasoning would work. Here, the BIA explained as well that the nexus failed because lead petitioner herself admitted that she did not know why she was attacked, and there was further a lack of evidence that would, you know, fail to compel a conclusion that the requisite causal nexus was established here. You know, in particular, she said it was based on that kinship, but since she left to the United States, she has some family left in Peru, some in the United States. Neither of them have experienced any more threats. And the lack of any more threats, combined with the fact that she herself was only speculating as to what the motivation of the attack was, means that under substantial evidence review, there is not enough to set aside the nexus.
So it sounds like you're saying, though, like, say the rest of the family had been attacked, and every time she was attacked, they said, we are attacking you because of your relative. We're attacking you because of your relative. Are you saying that that still can't be a family group because the brother was targeted for other reasons about being in a union? Or are you just saying the facts here don't rise to the level of a family group being targeted because of the brother?
I think that would raise additional questions as to, you know, that it was persecution rather than criminality, certainly in order.
But as to nexus, so I'm getting at this because we have a case called Rodriguez-Zuniga that suggests that it's never enough, even no matter how obvious the family connection is for the second person, if the targeting of the relative, the first person, is for a reason other than family, for theft, for retribution, for whatever. When you target the next family member to get at the first family member, it can never be a nexus. Maybe that case is wrong. It seems like the reasoning the IJ and BIA might have used here is that that kind of nexus isn't okay. I think you're kind of acknowledging it could be okay, just it has to be bad enough harm and bad enough family, but the idea of it being a family nexus is okay in theory.
Your Honor, I don't think we're making that as a square concession. I think it's just as presented here, there's no need to reach it because the nexus finding is a finding of fact. It's only reviewable for substantial evidence, and there is certainly not enough evidence here to compel a conclusion that no reasonable fact finder could have made the nexus finding that the IJ did here.
Counsel, we have some language in our case law that says family is the quintessential particular social group. We see that in Parada. We see that in another case, Rio. Do you read that? I mean, she's alleging kinship. Let's assume for these purposes that kinship is family. Why isn't that enough under that case law? Someone who asserts family, that automatically confers PSG status.
Well, I think there is certainly mixed case law on this, and I don't think that that, you know, this case really presents the vehicle certain to resolve that. Certainly it's not briefed in any particular depth. I think you would certainly need to be cautious in that instance, because if family, you know, is per se a PSG and that's enough, you would then have a lot of concerns with, it's not persecution, because it may just be ordinary criminality where, you know, using Judge Beatty's example, it may just be a target of random criminality or target of opportunity that suddenly gets transformed by overly loose PSG into persecution, when it's really just ordinary garden variety crime, which is not what Congress intended for, you know, to make out as a viable asylum claim.
Counsel, I've been thinking about a kind of a thorny issue, because I understand there are not only BIA decisions, but AG decisions that have pretty clearly decided that a family by itself is not automatically a PSG. One still needs to go through the three criteria of what constitutes a PSG: immutability, particularity, and social distinction, right? And so if those administrative decisions, those DOJ decisions, are in tension or in conflict with Ninth Circuit case law, in a post-Loper-Bright world, what do we do?
That's messy, Your Honor. So Loper-Bright suggests that stare decisis, you know, to the extent that it attached to your prior decisions, it continues to have force, even though you might have applied Chevron deference in the prior precedent and Chevron is no longer good law. Those precedents should still be good law. Now that's kind of the Supreme Court applying Loper-Bright to itself. I think it then gets very messy if you were to ever go en banc in a post Loper-Bright world. And what's the stare decisis effect of that? Candidly, I'm not sure. You guys will have to wrestle with that, I suspect. So I can certainly articulate the general principle, which is that Chevron's overruled, but Loper-Bright makes clear that the stare decisis of effect of prior precedents, including of this court that relied on Chevron as an analytical method to reach the decision it did, are still good law. You know, how that comes into play in future cases.
I agree that our own precedent requires us to look at the elements of a PSG, right?
I think so, Your Honor. I mean, it's certainly at that level of generality. I mean, yes, you certainly need to analyze that legal claim.
Before you conclude, I don't know if I heard your answer on how much is too much time under Nikin.
Your Honor, I don't think that there is a hard and fast rule. I think the nature of the administrative stay needs to be the touchstone. An administrative stay can be issued for as long as it takes for the court to decide the issue, but it cannot be a sort of indefinite, because then it becomes a de facto, you know, stay pending appeal or stay pending review. It has to be a stay only for so long as the court is needed for the court to decide the real stay motion, which is why administrative stays are often granted by explicitly disclaiming any analysis of the merits. And so certainly what you have here, where it persisted for months or in other cases even for years, that is not an acceptable or lawful administrative stay under Nikin. You know, where that line is will probably depend on many circumstances. You know, if for example, we gave the hypothetical of what happens if the government requests an extension on its, filing an op, and, you know, it's certainly hard to fault the court for letting the administrative stay continue during that pendency, because it doesn't have what it needs to decide the stay motion.
And you're not citing any case for that other than Nikin.
Well, the nature of an administrative stay, I think Justice Barrett's concurrence in United States versus Texas, this court's decision in Doe 1 versus
but
Trump.
The concurrence took into account the challenges for a court in processing these.
It certainly didn't bless the sort of open-ended that we have here as identified. And I think this court's decision in Doe 1 versus Trump 2 also makes clear that administrative stay is only, you know, permissible for as long as the court needs to decide the stay motion. It's not an open-ended, you know, full-blown stay pending appeal or stay pending review.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May I continue? Very briefly, I just wanted to note that the family relationship exists independently of the harm. And I believe Diaz-Reynoso does state that the question is whether the group itself is defined exclusively by the harm, which is not the case here. Here, the non-circular group is the immediate family of the brother, and the harm proves why the family was targeted. It does not define the family itself. And then very briefly, I just wanted to touch on the withholding of removal issue, because the BIA stated the petitioners failed asylum and therefore failed withholding, and then also very briefly stated that it considered the a reason standard, but again, it was very conclusory and did not independently analyze that part, which is important because there is a differentiation there in that there's different burdens of proof for the petitioner in that case.
Counsel, on your PSG articulation again, you said immediate family of the brother, but the PSG you articulated before the IJ and before the BIA was, again, kinships targeted by gangs, right?
Yes. That
broader PSG?
Yes, that's correct. But again, our argument is that PSG is not simply defined by targeted by gangs. It's defined by the family relationship in this case. And unless there's any more questions, I think I will end there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flores Rodriguez. I really do appreciate, on behalf of the court, your coming in person to argue this case. And Mr. Ensign, thank you very much for your oral argument presentation. Case of Maricruz Marisol Rojas Espinosa versus Todd Blanche is now submitted, and we are adjourned. Thank you.